This is the July 7 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists today include Ellen Dearden of AgriView from Morton, Illinois, Greg Ginder of FC Stone out of Chesterfield, Missouri, Dan Zwicker of Zwicker Consulting from Waco, Texas, and Alan Brugler of Brugler Marketing and Management out of Omaha, Nebraska. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find this program and all of our daily agricultural programming online at WILLAG.org. Follow us on Twitter at Commodity Week or look us up on Facebook.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
Let's begin, as usual, with a list of items we should discuss for the day. Ellen Dearden from AgriView, what do you have on your list?
Let's talk about soybean fund long liquidation. You know, we've certainly seen funds love the bean market and had extended their long holdings way up above 210,000 contracts early in June. Looks like they're down maybe 150-ish now, but it's been a huge factor in the market.
Greg Ginder of FC Stone.
I think some of the key important things is the weather and the potential crop size that we're having. It looks like it is going to be another above average year on the yield, and good possibility we could see an expansion of the balance sheet.
And Dan Zwicker of Zwicker Consulting.
How farm programs distort farmer decisions and the movement of higher production in the Western Corn Belt.
Well, you don't want to get into some tall weeds there, Alan Brugler. How about you of Brugler Marketing and Management?
Well, I think we ought to talk a little bit about Brazil with CONAB's production number changes this morning. And, you know, they got corn fired up for a while, and then we gave it back. Or we can also talk about China and the flooding over there and if that has any impact on either demand or supply.
Let's start with the WASDE, or the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Those are something we probably ought to take up. Greg Ginder, you mentioned that as a possibility and what the balance sheets might look like. The next set is due out next week. What's on your mind there?
Well, I guess the big question, or the glaring question, is what is the bean production number going to look like this year, and the per acre yield, and how that has an effect on the ending stocks going forward. I guess from those who I've talked to and the kind of different spots in the country, it sounds like although beans may be a little short, they may yield considerably better than what we thought maybe about a month ago. So I think the big question is, do we see a ending stock somewhere in the neighborhood of 350 for the 16-17 ending stocks, or are we looking at something closer to maybe 450? I guess, given by what I've heard, I would have to lean to the 400 side of the ending stocks, and I think that you're kind of seeing that in this kind of downturn in the bean market with the conditions that we've had right now and the weather that we've had across the Midwest. So I'd be interested to see if that point of view was shared with the rest of the panelists.
Alan Brugler, what do your numbers look like?
Well, we're expecting USDA to be somewhere in that 370 area for new crop ending stocks next week, because we don't think they'll change the yield number from what they were using the month earlier. They'll probably wait for NAS to come out with their survey data in August. I think one of the wild cards, though, is double crop acres. USDA was showing us in the June 30th report only 5% double crop acres for beans, but you've had this at one point a $3 rally in beans, basically telling producers to do more double crop, and you've got winter wheat harvest running a little ahead of schedule. So, you know, that may be the number for the July report, but it could actually get a little bigger in terms of the final acreage when we're all said and done.
Let me double check. So you're thinking 370 as the carryout for the 2016-17
correct
crop
correct
year?
Or
And that would be up substantially from the 260 million bushels USDA came out in the month of June. How do you get there?
Well, you've got more acreage. The June report didn't have the June 30th acres in it, all right? So you had the acreage increase. You had a harvested acreage increase as well. And you've also got, I think I may have a little bit more old crop carryover in there because of the grain stocks report. But primarily, it's the increase in acreage.
Ellen Dearden, can you take a look at those numbers and talk about the long liquidation that's taken place and put it all into some kind of perspective for me?
I kind of like to address this double crop acres. I think there was a lot of double crop that was planted and had been sitting in dry dirt, and then rains this past week have either washed out those beans or helped them emerge. So I think that Alan's right on target, thinking that perhaps we could be a little bit higher on our carryout. I would also like to suggest that I think the trade already has plugged in near record bean yield. I mean, we were at 48 last year. It was a new record. And with the updated weather forecast for August, and I know that's pretty far down the road, kind of the feeling is warm but wet instead of warm but dry, which is what people were thinking 2 weeks ago. So I, even if USDA comes out with using the higher acres and an unchanged yield, which is where I would expect them, I think we still could be in this 360 to 370 million bushel carryout for beans.
Okay, Dan, I'm going to come to you and ask you about the farm programs and how that distorts farmer decisions, because I think all of this plays into your hand.
Well, I think everybody's farming for the crop insurance price, and the crop insurance actuarial tables are, you know, they're distorted and they're subsidized. And you see the big increase of corn and soybean acres in the western and northwestern corn belt. And one of the primary reasons of that is that their land costs are cheaper. So it's easier for them to make money with the crop insurance price when it's based upon futures average rather than a cash average. Whereas the eastern Corn Belt farmer, especially east of the Mississippi River, have higher land costs. Real estate taxes are going up through the roof. So you can see that, like, state of Illinois really stayed unchanged in acres from last year. And you can see the expansion is all in the northwestern Corn Belt, and that's been going on. And what it is that land costs are cheaper, so the crop insurance price gives those farmers the incentive to plant. It gives the banker the incentive to loan the money. So you're distorting supply-demand decisions with farm programs. Now that's nothing new. That's been going on even before I was born. But that is what you're seeing. You would not have those type of corn and soybean acres in the Western Plains, Northwestern Corn Belt, if it was not for the crop insurance price. And that is what's it's moving production actually away from the usage areas. I mean, all your usage areas, your big crushing plants, Cedar Rapids, Decatur, and then your ethanol plants, your export market is your Illinois River, Mississippi River market. So that production is going further away from the basic main point. So I know farmers like crop insurance, but we're seeing a distortion of acres. It's just like flood insurance. It encourages people to build million-dollar homes on floodplains because the government offers subsidized flood insurance policy. And a perfect example, I had a daughter that her whole subdivision was built on a floodplain in Rosenberg, Texas. And, of course, it was levied up. They didn't get damaged, but that encourages flood insurance, just like crop insurance, encourages people to build on ground that they shouldn't be building on to start with. And that's so I guess my beef is crony capitalism with the government programs.
Well, I'll make a point here that there are usage areas in those places built out primarily by producers investing in renewable fuels and ethanol plants in particular, based on what the United States Congress thought the energy policy ought to look like in the U.S. and that they wanted more renewable energy in the United States. So there is a lot of ethanol plants out there. So I suspect maybe there's more usage there than potential. And on the flip side of that, Dan, the price of wheat is so darn low. I can't imagine that in these kind of years that there would be a lot of wheat being put out there. However, I suppose it could be hay acres.
Yeah, I mean, but the crop insurance price on wheat didn't incentivize anybody. And, you know, eventually that average price is going to catch up with everybody if we have these humongous carryovers that everybody wants to talk about. I would say next February prices may not be very attractive at all. Maybe they may be, you know, way below what anybody ever thought. And then that may end up finally getting the decisions back to an actual supply, you know, economic sense, rather than the government price distorting people's decisions.
Yeah, so part of that.
I'm going to be the most hated person in the Western Corn Belt. But,
maybe, however, the crop insurance and the farm programs themselves are designed in part, depending on which one you're looking at, the crop insurance inter-year and the farm programs over longer time frames to smooth out the transition from one year to the next in terms of the rapid change of prices that can take place. And certainly we can see that in what the ARC County program looks like, maybe to some extent in PLC as well, and within crop insurance. So it's something to debate, I suppose, in other places and other times as well. Now, let's move on and take a look at some other things. I would like to pick up with the weather forecast. Greg Ginder, this was on your mind. There are some that believe that the weather will maintain a warm and wet. However, some are thinking as they look further out that they just don't know beyond about the 20th day of July. I take it you're of a mind that the weather of the rest of the season is going to be pretty decent.
Well, as a minor meteorologist that I am, I you know, you do kind of look at the forward forecast out in the 14 days, and you can kind of assume that there is going to be somewhat of a, I guess you would call it an average or normal seasonal pattern that develops. You know, the concern was the whole time of the La Nina, hot and dry. Not that it didn't show up, but it was kind of hit and miss, you know, so it wasn't a prolonged period, I guess, like everybody was kind of looking towards the possibility of that being the case. I would have to probably err on the side of semi above average temperatures with average rainfall. I mean, I certainly don't expect any drought by any stretch of the imagination. Now, what we could see here out in the September time frame is the dryness start to come into effect, but I think that just plays into the farmers' hands more than anything, with the reduced drying charges and ability to get the crop out at a quick pace.
Alan Brugler, what are conditions like on the ground in your area today?
Well, we've just been on the periphery of the big rains that came across Kansas. We've had a good inch and a half, 2 inches here in the last few days. We've got severe thunderstorm watches in Omaha again for tonight. So the crop's fairly well watered. Maturity varies quite a bit. I see some corn every day that's head high but hasn't tasseled. There's beans that are, you know, knee high and looking pretty good, but in general, the crop is at least normal development. We had some air out in central Nebraska that was planted a little late because we had some wet weather earlier in the spring, but it's coming back pretty well. So no real quarrels with the crop conditions here in Nebraska and Kansas and northern Missouri.
Alan Dearden, there in the Peoria area, I would imagine there's an awful lot of tasseled corn.
There is a lot of tasseled corn, and if it's not tasseled already, it will in the next couple of days, especially with some sunshine. I would say maybe 15% of the corn has already pollinated locally.
Well, that's more than I had suspected. Dan, I know you drove up from Texas to the northwestern portion of Illinois. What'd you see on your drive?
Well, we came up through central Missouri, you know, up we turn off and go up through the Lake of the Ozarks and up through Mexico, Missouri, and over to Quincy and then up through western Illinois. And usually that northeast Missouri a lot of times looks a little shabby. They got lighter soils and it's hotter down there. But that area was actually looking pretty good when we came through that a week ago. And then, of course, what I saw through western Illinois and then up here by the Quad Cities is excellent. So I'm not going to quarrel with how green the crop looks. So if we're basing ratings on color, we got a high rating level, just like what the reports are suggesting.
However, you have your doubts?
Well, we got different stages to go through, and I know there's no doubt that these rains this past week has given us a corn crop. Now I guess we can start arguing how big it is and what would it take to shrink it up to a point that it would matter in the balance sheet that would actually make it more the market more price sensitive. But I have seen a lot of good crops on July 31st deteriorate significantly during the month of August in my career. That doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen, but it can happen. And another thing, I know some people think this is maybe crackpot, but I do watch the sunspot activity, and sunspot activity has fallen off the cliff. And I think that keeps us open, just like I mentioned last winter, for late freezes. And we got one of those. We got May freeze. And I think it keeps us open for an early freeze. And I guess I have a hard time thinking any sustained heat is going to be around. Yes, heat can show up, especially in Texas. But my guess is I would side for more of a cooler, drier pattern if I was going to side for anything as we finish out the growing season.
A couple of other items that have been listed by our guest, Alan Brugler, you mentioned that CONAB on Thursday morning, that's the day we record this program, by the way, reduced their production number down 7 million metric tons for both the first and the second crop, but most of it, I believe, came out of the second crop. What does that mean to the marketplace?
Well, basically, the bottom line is it affects their exports. Their estimate for exports for Brazil dropped to 22 million tons from 25.4 million. So you're talking about another 3 million tons of opportunity versus the June estimate, and actually about 8 million tons of opportunity where they were selling corn over the last marketing year that they won't have it in this next window here. This basically means up to 200 million bushels that's going to go into the world market from someplace else. Well, that's mostly United States. If it's Western Hemisphere, U.S. would be in position to get a lot of it out of Asia. It's not showing up yet. It just happened. But they're definitely down on their production. This was a much smaller old crop or second crop, Safrina crop number than what the trade had been looking for. And that's why we were up early on Thursday morning before the soybean meal sell-off caught us and took things back down. But it does point out that it is still a two-season year. It's always been that way since the 80s, at least, for the beans, you know, the U.S. season, the South American season. It's getting more that way on the corn. And I think what it says is you'll see some pretty strong corn export numbers for out of the U.S., particularly in the first quarter of the 16-17 marketing year. We've been tracking an indicator we call world minus U.S. and China. Basically, we take the corn ending stocks for the world out of WASDE, subtract the China, because that grain, a big chunk of the stocks are there, but it isn't going to leave China because they paid $8 a bushel to get it. And then we take out the U.S. and say, what's the export opportunity? Well, the point is that number is actually the tightest since 2012. So, we're staring at fairly big old crop ending stocks, and they'll probably go up on Tuesday because of what we saw on June 30th. But the export opportunity, the opportunity to move that product is there. And with this break in the prices, contract high to contract low in 2 weeks, we've definitely got the stuff on sale right now.
And I'll follow up with you since you mentioned China and was on your list. I take it it's the flooding maybe potentially that you've talked about there. I know that during the closing market report Wednesday afternoon, Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated said this is something we'll hear a lot more about in the coming days. And of course, it started to show up on national and international news as well. Does this create an opportunity for U.S. exports?
Well, it's going to depend on how it plays out. There were some reports of livestock losses, flooding taking out some fairly big livestock operations. Obviously, that's a negative for grain demand. But on the other hand, it's also taken out some corn and wheat production. And, their whole objective this year in China is to work down their corn stocks. They're not necessarily going to see an immediate reaction in terms of U.S. shipments in. But I think the anything that lowers the world carryout numbers, most people don't subdivide it like we do and take U.S. and China out and so on and so forth. Anything that lowers the world numbers for wheat or corn is going to tend to be a little supportive to the overall perception of what the price level ought to be.
Ellen Dearden, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the feed and residual numbers from the grain stocks report, how they changed, and what your estimate of what that'll mean in WASD might be, and how you put that into the number of animals you believe happens to be in the domestic supply at the moment.
I think the numbers are way higher than what people are believing they are. The thing is that we don't just feed corn. We feed wheat, and that wheat number, I think, wheat feeding ought to be moving up. Whether we're at 400 million bushel, that may be a little bit too rich, but we're also feeding a lot of milo. And notice that those milo stocks were extremely high, and so that milo feeding is very active. And I think that we're feeding a lot more DDGs and not just whole corn in that mix. So we've been looking at the ethanol grind as really strong. But I think the livestock feeding stuff is all over the place. I see a number of feedlots who have bought wheat directly from farmers that have never done that before in the Kansas and Oklahoma panhandles. So I don't think that's going to be terribly unusual.
Greg Ginder, how is the export market in the St. Louis area acting at this time?
It's actually very firm. With the board break on both corn and beans, it's been an opportunity for basis to continue to appreciate it. It's one of those functions where they need to make the cash price kind of more attractive, and basis traders have been really encouraged by it. Just a side note on what Alan said about the Brazilian corn, I would agree, and it kind of ties into the basis levels in the domestic markets as well. If the U.S. does manage to kind of fill the void that Brazil leaves behind, the river houses will surely show that in their basis levels. St. Louis, just to give an example, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 over on corn and nearly 30 or so over on beans. So it is certainly a good time to be long basis. The only side note to that would be is barge freight. But barge freight has been increasing at a fairly steady level, and it's primarily due to the run-up in the demand and the full pipeline that we had. Many of the barge companies had set barges off out of the system so that they could maintain a certain level of break-even barge freight. So what you're seeing is those barges are now fitting their way into the system, and they've kind of put a bit of a resistance or a lid on the cost of barge freight. So that's also kind of a little component that we just keep track of here, just to make sure that you know, one is not getting completely out of whack with the others.
So, Dan, as I understand this, then we have very low prices for corn. Everybody knows that. We have an export market that may have been expanded just slightly this week by the CONAB number. We also have those areas in the eastern corn belt that we know were short of supplies of corn because of the crop last year. Still some overs being paid in parts of the corn belt. Indiana, I talked to this week at Logansport at the ethanol plant there. They were over. How does this all build into the way you technically see the marketplace?
Well, I watch the cash chart probably as a more of a leading indicator than some of the futures charts, because I think cash is a more of a solid market. It reflects more of the fundamentals, probably, where your futures market is so highly traded and you get such wide swings, especially what we've experienced. Like Alan said, you go from contract high to contract low and in the 12 days, that's a pretty volatile situation in the commodity market. Well, if you talk to any grain buyers after the grain stocks report, they were sick. I know the grain trade likes to buy grain as cheap as they can, but they want to be able to buy it. And these low prices makes it real difficult for the grain industry to buy, get their hands on cash inventory. And the only way they can really get their hands on cash inventory, as Greg has mentioned, is basis levels are going to stay very stout and maybe improve significantly in some areas. It all depends. I do know that the export people that I talk to, they've been actually working a 75 million ton crop out of Brazil. So that's really not new to them. They have been extremely bullish exports of both corn and soybeans. I mean, they've really, and I doubt if they've got their needs covered. So I do think the export demand underneath this market, as well as the domestic demand that we have in ethanol, it's going to keep corn somewhere in here. We're going to stabilize the futures, and then the cash market is going to have to go to work to bring those supplies into the market. And my guess is, just like last year, we had strong basis levels. We'll probably end for that again this coming year, unless something changes. Because, like I said, the grain buyers are—they ain't talking to any farmers. I can tell you what, the phones ain't ringing, and they got a commitment. And they're going to have to go get it. So there could be some very attractive basis contracts offered, delayed pricing contracts, whatever, to try to get that grain moving into the pipeline at some point in time.
Okay, Alan Dearden, I want to stitch this back together with the long liquidations from the fund side. Will they liquidate enough that the market, and you'll have to tell me whether you think it's been trading fundamentals, which probably has based off the USDA numbers, and whether those numbers actually match what the price tag in Chicago happens to be. So can we liquidate enough of the long fund position in order to stabilize and then bring back up the price of corn and soybeans is really the question.
I think we've liquidated quite a bit this past week, both in the corn and beans. I think we are closer to an equilibrium situation in the corn than in the beans at this stage of the game, with November beans in this 10.25 range. It appears to me that the trade, if you want to talk about the funds looking at fundamentals, the trade has the corn yield up over 170 bushels and the bean yield up close to that 48 bushel yield. And based on improving conditions from here. So if that should happen to change, or if we would go berserk price-wise, rally sharply and take out some of these moving averages, we would add to long futures. But I think while we're in this liquidation mode, it kind of feeds on itself. I would think that December corn futures is going to find awfully good support in the 335 to 350 range right where we're at.
Hey, Alan Brugler, what do you think the chances are that for this crop year we now have both the contract high and contract low in?
Well, probably you're talking about the old crop or the new crop?
New crop.
New crop. That's a stretch. I mean, you've got basically another 15 months to go on that to put in your contract high, contract low. I think the range is appropriate. The average range is about $1.20 a bushel from low to high during any given marketing year going back to 1980. So, yeah, we've had that scale of a move. Our model, though, is very sensitive to what that final production and yield becomes. As an example, if you end up with your ending stocks for new crop bumping up closer to 2.5 billion, that'd be a 171 or 172 yield probably. Then you're talking 310 to 3.25 cash, and your low futures might be as low as 275 sometime during that 12 to 15 month period. So if the yield goes higher, we probably haven't seen the full range. I can say on the old crop that our model says if 360 or 365 is your cash price, the low futures for the year should be around 330, and we're just about there. We traded 333 this week.
Dan, how about you?
Let's put it this way. With this negative interest rate policy that we basically have every place but here in the United States, and there's some that believe that we may go to negative interest rate, this negative interest rate has made a lot of money available to try to find some kind of return to run. And I visited with a trader friend of mine, and we talked about maybe what we just saw in corn and soybeans, where everybody runs into a market and all the money goes in and then it all pulls out, that we could see a lot of this stuff in several different commodities in several different times during the next 12 months. So if there's a reason for them to come in and lay all their money in there and go one way or the other, I think we're probably entering the 12 months here that could be very volatile and a lot of spikes up and a lot of spikes down. I think the door is open for about anything. My biases would, even though it maybe would go against the fundamental thinking at this point in time, is that there's going to be better pricing opportunities in the next 12 months. But we may also, go lower first. But I think all this printing of money eventually is going to result in total consumer confidence of what the dollar's worth and or whatever the yen's worth or whatever the British pound's worth. And it's going to be a wild market over the next 12 months.
Okay, so I've got one last question before we get to our final comments from each of you. And Ellen, I'll start with you on the final comments. But at 1025 November soybeans, this is well above the crop insurance price, but well below now the high price for the year. If you have done nothing, does this remain an opportunity to make a first set of sales? Dan?
I don't have any problems at $10 when someone's looking at the crop prospects they are. I mean, $10 is better than $9 that a lot of guys got sold at. So if you don't have nothing done, I sure would not talk anybody out of selling something at $10. I mean, I assume it's going to be profitable if we have the yield that it looks like we're going to have.
Alan Brugler?
Yeah, again, you had plenty of opportunities to do more than that. But, yeah, I would agree with the you know, 10-20 type thing is better than risking it. There's a danger of, okay, I missed the high, I'm going to wait for a bounce back. And in these kind of volatile markets, when that money, hot money's flowing in and out, you don't get that opportunity all the time. Corn's a different matter. I have a lot of trouble trying to sell corn here at this price.
Greg Ginder?
I would also agree that it is not a bad time to do any sales. Well, the only thing I would say is that given the way that we've seen basis reacting to some of these lower numbers, is I would be more inclined to do some sort of futures only contract to just lock in the board price and then work my way around the basis in the months of delivery. It feels like to me, so long as we keep leaning on these futures, the basis will continue to do majority of the heavy lifting to provide a price that is you know, at least somewhat attractive. So that's probably what I would do instead of selling a further out basis where there's probably, it's probably a little wider than it needs to be. I would probably wait and lock it in upon delivery.
And Ellen Dearden, and then your final word for the day.
I absolutely would be selling beans if I'd not made any sales. However, we're not in that boat. And I would also prefer to wait to lock in basis. There is some much improved basis from fall till December and January. So there must be a large book of export business in that time slot, at least out of the Gulf. My final comment for the day is watch this crude market. Dan talked about money in and money out of some markets, and by golly, we sure have seen that in this crude market. I think we're ready for much more bounce than this sideways market that we've seen the last several weeks.
Ellen Dearden, of course, is with AgriView out of Morton, Illinois. Dan Zwicker is with Zwicker Consulting in Waco, Texas. Your final word?
Fasten your seatbelt. This rodeo's not over with.
And Greg Ginder from FC Stone in Chesterfield, Missouri.
It's hard to follow that one. But, no, I would say keep your eyes on the weather as if most people weren't already doing that. And check in at your local elevators from time to time. Keep your eye on the basis as well, because that's going to be an interesting component this summer.
And Alan Brugler of Brugler Marketing and Management out of Omaha, Nebraska.
We talk about prices here, but we need to talk about prices in dollar terms. And the crude oil market is a classic example. It trades as a currency. The dollar is still seeing some pressure on the British pound from the Brexit decision, and nobody's really sure the timing of that breakup with the EU. But I'd point out just a kind of a micro fact here, and that is we look at the dollar and figure if the dollar is up, the commodities are down and vice versa. But the dollar isn't itself anymore. The British pound seeing most of the action against the dollar. You've actually got the yen going the other way against the buck. Euro's kind of been on both sides. Be careful in looking at the dollar index and assuming the market's going to act normal. It's just not it's not a normal pattern right now with those components moving like they are.
You've been listening, of course, to Commodity Week. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org. Our thanks to our guests today, including Dan Zwicker of Zwicker Consulting, Greg Ginder of FC Stone, Ellen Dearden of AgriView, and Alan Brugler of Brugler Marketing and Management. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.